Welcome. I'm your host, Henry Arslanian, and welcome to this episode of the Future of Money podcast. As you guys know, my goal with this podcast is very clear, is to go deep in some of the biggest ideas, trends, and developments we are seeing in the field of crypto, and hopefully empower you with this information, and then let you make your own decision on what their impact can be on the future of money and the future of finance. Before I start, guys, a big thank you to the 500,000 of you who are following my content each week. This podcast, The Future of Money, is now ranked in the top 5% of all podcasts globally on Spotify. Thousands of you from over 160 countries are tuning in each week. So a massive, massive thank you from bottom of my heart. Today is a very special episode because literally we're going to talk about my favorite report of the year. And I know people will get pissed off about when I say this, and I should not have any favorites, but this is a report. I have a tradition every year. I print it. I know it's not very eco-friendly, and I go have a cigar and I actually go read it. It's really, I love every page of it. And it's the Crypto Crime Report by Chainalysis. And for full disclosure, Chainalysis is a sponsor of many of my educational content on crypto. And I can't wait now to go and discuss this report and share some of the highlights with all of you. And we're joined for that with Eric Jardine, who is the cybercrimes research lead at Chainalysis. Eric, great. Thanks for being on the Future of Money podcast.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you for the invitation. I look forward to chatting everything through.
So Eric and I, we have many things in common. A part of the Canada Link, Eric also is based in Canada. Well, I used to be, not anymore. But Eric is also an amateur fencer and has dabbled in fencing throughout his life, which I have to say, Eric and I were discussing before we went live that how much a big chunk of my life was into fencing as well, especially when I was in high school and college. So here we go. Who thought fencing and crypto had something in common? But Eric, you prove that point.
Oh, there we go. Yeah. Canadian fencing, crypto.
Boom. Good. So Eric, I want to go in. I think this is a report. I love every part of it. And I think we'll make sure that in the link on YouTube, people have the link to the report. But you know, there's a lot of talk in the press about crypto crime. If you ask the average person on the road, often they'll tell you, crypto is being used for money laundering, crypto is being used for criminal activities, and so on and so forth. Can you maybe share with our audience the main takeaway from this report? Is basically that the illicit activity has come down. Before we start, can you maybe explain to our audience what is the latest data that you guys have when it comes to illicit activity in crypto? And also, what is your definition of illicit activity to make sure that we actually have the foundations in place before we dig deeper?
Sure. So I think the definition dimension is probably important to start with, just that way everyone's on the same page about what, let's say, a multi-billion dollar figure might mean. So what we do is we take our sort of the on-chain infrastructure and we overlay an attribution of real world identity onto it. And so through that process, we're able to say, for example, this wallet is associated with a darknet market. So something like Silk Road, Alpha Bay, Hydra, depending on, you know, what period of time you're looking at, or it's associated with a sanctioned jurisdiction or a sanctioned entity or, a stolen fund activity or something of that nature, ransom or whatever. And so it's those sorts of categories ranging from, you know, on-chain value movement associated with, say, drug exchange through, payments of ransoms, scamming activity, things of that nature. And we take all of that and we kind of, use a various heuristics and other things to make sense of what's going on chain. And then we can take those values and we can aggregate them together to give an estimate of total dollars and an estimate of a share of those total dollars associated with illicit activity as a function of everything else in the on-chain universe, which I think is an important point of context. And so if you look at those two numbers to try to take what we do in terms of like categories and so forth and put it into dollars and then put it into percent, in dollar terms, in 2023, we were looking at about $24.2 billion in illicit activity, which sounds like a lot, but it's actually a drawdown from the previous year that was cresting $39 billion. And then if you look at it as a share, you get kind of a different representation. So just to be clear on what this means, this is kind of like your crimes per capita type approach, where rather than saying like there's 100 murders, you'd say there's, you know, one murder per 100,000 people, something like that. And so when we express illicit activity as a share, we get 0.34% in 2023. So that's the percent of all on-chain activity that is illicit. And I like to think about the share as probably a pretty accurate barometer for the big statements when people say it's all used for money laundering. It's like, it's more or less a 1% problem, but 1% rounding up. So being extra conservative here, rounding up, 1% of on-chain activities kind of per se, potentially illicit over time.
And I think, Eric, what's interesting is, thanks for that clarification, is actually, I've been following this report now for many years, is that the data gets amended every year as well. And as you mentioned, very in your report that I have in front of me, by the way, is that actually, because when the transactions are touching illicit addresses, often it takes, there's a couple of weeks or months it takes before you guys can identify that these wallets are illicit, actually, which is very interesting. But I think the number of 0.34% and is I think obviously relatively interesting, but also the fact that it's, we're talking about only, I know only is again a very relative term, of 24 billion. I think if you ask a lot of people that work in the financial industry or other sectors, you would expect this number to be higher from that perspective as well. But maybe can you share as well with our audience, what are the type of coins, what crypto assets are you seeing being involved increasingly in this kind of illicit activities, based on your data that you have from your report?
Sure. There's this, the historical view is that crypto is sort of like loosely equal to Bitcoin. Now that was in 2013, 2014, 2015, 20 up into 2018. This is sort of, I think, a correct view that most illicit activity was confined to Bitcoin with some sort of dabbling in other chains. But what we increasingly observed is that alongside the rise of stablecoins generally in terms of their use globally, we've seen also a rise in stablecoins as a form of exchange for illicit activity. So as we come into 2023, stablecoins are eating up a fairly sizable proportion of total illicit activity. Now there's a lot of contextualization there that we can talk about, because not all forms of illicit activity are the same. Obviously some are going to be weighted towards some chains mm-hmm. more heavily than others, and we can talk about that. But yeah, we've seen a bit of a substitution. So, you know, Bitcoin's, you know, still fairly predominant, but its dominance has dropped significantly in the last 2 years, three, if depending on how you're kind of looking at the trend.
Yeah. So it's very interesting, actually. You touched on a topic that I want to bring up, because when the readers go on the report and you really see that in 2020, 2023, the share of illicit transactions being done in stablecoins is now actually almost the majority, actually more than the majority of it are using stablecoins. So can you double click on this? What are the type of illicit activities that you are seeing being increasingly used by stablecoin as a medium of exchange in those transactions? And yeah. Second is, why do you think there's no deterrent? In many cases of these stablecoins, the stablecoin issuer is able to freeze the wallets, as we've seen over and over the last couple of months. Why do you think that is not acting as a deterrent compared to people using Bitcoin, for example?
Sure. Yeah. So I think the interesting thing is, I think it is acting as a deterrent, just to start at the end and then work our way backwards through the things you wanted to talk about there. And the reason that I say that is some forms of crime, so for example, ransomware, is like 100% Bitcoin. And the reason is, if you were trying to operate as a ransomware gang, running on stablecoins, given what we've observed, where stablecoin issuers are able to freeze funds, is a terrible plan. Like you're going to ask for a ransom, you're going to get paid, but they're also the payee is probably going to be talking with an issuer to get the funds frozen. So there is, I think, a deterrent effect from that, the ability of stablecoin issuers to freeze funds. And that's why we haven't seen some of the more predatory forms of cybercrime, like stolen fund activity, ransomware, pivoting very heavily in that direction. Now, what's to work with from there forward, it's when we look at, let's say, 2023 and scratch the surface and sort of say, where is this stablecoin volume coming from? It's largely confined to three areas. It's sanctioned entities, sanctioned jurisdictions, and then scams. And what's interesting about these three categories, beyond the fact that they all start with an S, which is completely immaterial, is that they are in some way barometers, I think, of overall crypto adoption and activity. So in the case of sanctioned entities, you wouldn't necessarily think that that would be a barometer of activity, but it depends on which sanctioned entity you're talking about. So the large Russian exchange Garantex was sanctioned in 2022 in April. And unlike a lot of the turn of events with sanctions, this particular service pushed back at OFAC, the Office of Foreign Assets Control in the United States, and said, we're not going to shut down. The US does not have jurisdiction over us. We are a Russian-based exchange, predominantly serving Russian users. I mean, they were engaged in ransomware laundering, which was the purpose of the sanctions, but they're in operation. They continue to be in operation. And what we're seeing with something like a large volume of stablecoin activity associated with sanctioned entities is basically that an exchange, like all exchanges, has a fair amount of inflows and outflows associated with stablecoin activity. The same with something like sanctioned jurisdiction. It's going to be largely driven by sanctioned services in places like Iran or Venezuela. You're going to see something similar, like a crypto ecosystem is as a whole, you know, not talking about the illicit dimensions, just everybody is pivoting heavily towards stable coins. You know, they're fast, they're cheap, they peg value, et cetera, et cetera. And so what we've seen with those two categories is like, it's basically mirroring that movement. And the interesting thing with scams, because that's the third category, it's not quite as heavy of a concentration, but it's still there, is that it's the same thing. It's like scams are tethered to what's happening in the market. So Larry Fink keeps offering me free crypto on YouTube at this moment in time. And that's because of the ETF issuance, because this is a new player. Like scams are tethered to what's going on in the ecosystem. And so they'll be using what's predominant in the ecosystem, which is stablecoins, as we document more generally. So that's, I think when we drill in, stablecoins is eating up such a big share, just partially, and if not mainly, because stablecoins are just a big part of crypto nowadays.
Very, very interesting. I think this will kind of have a whole different discussion on the role of stablecoins, not only actually in such activities, but in monetary policy and economic stability as well. So I want to talk about a couple of the verticals in the report, and maybe about different types of crypto crime, and actually discuss some of the nuances around. For example, you mentioned earlier ransomware, right? In the report, you guys did a very interesting job in defining and actually showcasing examples of ransomware as a service, where groups are using it and literally make it a pretty much a white label solution for criminals to be able to use. What I find interesting is that in the event of ransomware, you're seeing a big chunk of these, obviously, because you can have the ransom, but a big chunk of the ransomware proceeds are being laundered afterwards via centralized exchanges. And this is something I think we also saw when it comes to money laundering. Why do you think centralized exchanges are still playing a role when it comes as an off-ramp for such illicit activities?
I think it's partially because when you think about the laundering process, it goes from, you know, efforts to obscure, which, you know, there could be any number of steps in that broad bucket. But then eventually, because we don't live on a Bitcoin standard yet, you're sort of you have to head towards the door or the ramp to fiat. And centralized services are essentially one of the primary ways in which, you know, by and large, the ecosystem would make that conversion. Now, there are others. There's things like gambling services that would be kind of a bridge in and out of the on-chain to off-chain environment. But because centralized services are just the primary door in and out, that is why, you know, eventually a lot of activity eventually touches that particular edge of the ecosystem.
And I presume here speed is of the essence for these criminals, right? Because obviously when these wallets identified by services like yourselves, Chainalysis and other similar traceability vendors as a illicit address, of course, there'll be flags that will come in pretty much all the big exchanges now are regulated somewhere. They have to use such traceability solutions. So I guess from a speed perspective, I don't know if you guys have any data or color on that. for these players involved in illicit activities, they, I presume, they're trying to move the money, the assets to fiat off ramp as soon as possible.
Yeah, I don't have any data on the tip of my tongue here, because I think it's fair to say, you know, thinking about it somewhat abstractly, I think it's fair to say that speed would be one strategy. Mm-hmm. So yeah, if you can get, if you steal funds, if you extort ransom, if you scam funds, whatever it happens to be, there's definitely a case to be made for the idea of you move it as fast as you can, as fast as the block confirmations will let you, to an exit point, and you try to convert from there.
Yeah.
Now, that would be a strategy, but there could be others that would be less likely to prioritize time, but instead, for example, prioritize complexity. So you're instead going to be emphasizing movement to mixers, movement to bridges in order to swap between chains, mixtures of those where you're swapping to through chains, then hitting a mixer, then moving to an instant exchange and converting currency, and then hitting another instant exchange and then moving. So you're trying, you won't be going fast, but you will be going like in a very roundabout route that would potentially emphasize the laundering aspect rather than the off-ramp aspect. And the goal would be to essentially, in both cases, you're trying to essentially make that final step and get out of the asset in question and into the fiat currency of choice. You're just sort of using a different strategy to do it. And they're not at the margin, maybe totally mutually exclusive, but like, obviously you can't move super fast if you're doing all these additional steps necessarily.
Yeah. I think it's also very interesting that you guys mentioned this in the report. I think the top, I think it's like something like top five exchanges, deal with about 70% of assets being off-ramped. So I mean, these are centralized exchanges that are getting a big chunk of the flow of illicit illicit funds. One thing as well I'd love to discuss is when it comes to bridges and mixers. I mean, what is the role that cross-chain bridges and mixers are playing when it comes to broader money laundering in crypto?
Yeah, so it's mixers in particular are an interesting case in point. I mean, they're volume overall has actually declined to about half a billion in 2023 from a little over a billion in 2022. Now there's potential currency effects and other things that might be at play there, but you know they're a staple, whereas bridges are sort of a new and or emergent category. And in both cases, I think at a like functionality level, they're trying to do something somewhat similar, which is sort of launder and therefore obfuscate the trail, try to break that connection between the illicit action on the front end and the wherever it's destined to end up at the other end of things.
Interesting, very interesting on that perspective and the role it's playing. I want to move to hacks. So obviously, I think in the report you guys categorize them as stolen funds, but let's say about hacking, which is still a big problem in crypto. When we look at the crypto ecosystem as a whole, based on the data that I'm seeing in the report, it seems that hacking is really a DeFi problem, not a CeFi problem. What's your view on that, and why are we seeing more hacking activity when it comes to decentralized protocols and exchanges?
Yeah, so I think there's a great chart in the report that really shows that it's in the last 3 years, it's really a DeFi problem, and in the 5 years before that, it's really a CeFi problem. And so, like you'd kind of expect, it somewhat depends in terms of who's getting targeted, how good their security practices are, how much value they have at risk. Like those are three predominant dimensions to this broad category of problem. But yeah, we've definitely seen DeFi maintain a fairly dominant share. It did drop a little bit in 2023 relative to the past 2 years. Part of that can be attributed to some fairly high profile hacks that weren't related to DeFi per se. And then also to just lower value at risk in the DeFi ecosystem, because TVL overall across all chains is, it's certainly recovering along with asset prices over the last little while, but it's still way, way, way down from where it was, say, 2021, 2020, part of 2022. So yeah, there's this sort of interesting, the way I tend to think about this particular category of activity is that the people behind the hacks, or the organizations, depending, they do not care what they target. They want to steal as much as they can in the most straightforward way possible. So they'll go where the money is. They'll target things that are, you know, comparatively vulnerable. And so increases in security practices and centralized services might be part of the reason there was a pivot towards DeFi, or if in relative terms, DeFi was a little bit worse at security. If DeFi gets better at security, you might see a move in a different direction, so on and so forth. So, yeah.
So it's very, very interesting. You know, and in the report, you mentioned about the role that North Korea, for example, plays with the Lazarus Group, and you guys have some practical examples. For example, the atomic wallet exploit and others have taken place by North Korea. When you look at hacking, do you believe that a lot of these are state-backed and state-sponsored, like in the case of North Korea? And who do you think are the leaders, quote-unquote, when it comes to crypto hacking?
I think, yeah. So in the case of, say, the DPRK, it's definitely the case that they're both state-backed in some capacity or another. And one of the largest threat actors in the space. It was like, there's no question. You just look at it in terms of dollar amounts. So they crested $1 billion in 2023. That was down a lot from their 2022 totals, but so was stolen fund activity overall. And so they're eating up a, you know, a lion's share of the totals that we observe. And so on that basis, like straight away, it's just they have to be treated as the predominant threat actor in the space. Now, whether the other instances that we observe, of which there are, you know, dozens to hundreds every year, whether those are associated with state-backed actors is a little bit more nebulous, because, you know, there's people trying to compromise services all the time. I would guess that without having data to necessarily back this up with a percentage or a anything other than just sort of my intuition, I would assume most of them aren't, would be my guess. But, you know, it does, as the DPRK section of the report makes clear, one or two well-funded state-backed organizations or entities can do a tremendous amount of damage. So it's good that they're probably not mostly state-backed, because it kind of limits the hardship that they can waste onto the ecosystem.
Yeah, it's been very interesting actually looking at what certain groups like the Lazarus Group have been doing in the crypto space the last couple of years. You know, they've been definitely very sophisticated in their crypto knowledge and capabilities, from that perspective. I want to touch upon, let's go down. Another thing I want to talk about is market manipulation. There's a quote in the report, which I love. I think it's such a shocking quote in a way that I'm surprised actually not more people are talking about this. But let me quote something from your report. And you say, quote, 54% of ERC-20 tokens listed on DEXs, decentralized exchanges, in 2023 display patterns that may be suggestive of pump and dump schemes, but represent just 1.3% of DEX decentralized exchanges trading volume. So just to put this in normal English, basically half of the ERC-20 tokens are listed may be actually being involved in pump and dump schemes, basically market manipulation. But when you're looking at this holistically, it's around 1% of all volumes on decentralized exchanges. What are you seeing on the market manipulation side? Do you believe that obviously this is an area we're going to see more and more interest and more scrutiny over the next couple of months and years, especially as DeFi volumes are increasing? And do you think this kind of displays of patterns are going to continue?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a very low barrier to entry to starting new ERC-20s, for example. And so I think those numbers, what they really show is that, you know, most of crypto is not necessarily like anything to do with the sort of scammy pump and dump market manipulation type behavior. That's where that 1% of trading volume comes into play. But at a raw number level, like the number of projects that can potentially be people engaging in that form of activity, that's actually rather high. So it's this interesting dynamic where you kind of got to, you know, think about how the two metrics resonate, but it has some pretty clear, I think, implications for what's going on in the space. Now, I think market integrity questions are like these ones. They're bound to get the attention of regulators over time. That, you know, it's just, I don't know exactly how that will play out. And it's going to be very, I would assume, very just jurisdictionally dependent, because obviously different rules, different places, all that sort of thing. But the fact that it's unlike in a lot of, say, traditional finance, like the barrier to entry to start up a project is really low, which means there's a lot more like scope for abuse at that low end, even if we don't see it really dominating transaction volumes or anything of that sort.
Yeah, very interesting. There's another section that you guys discuss, which is the child sexual abuse material. It's interesting because you guys refer to it as CSAM. For somebody like me who's been working on finance for many years, it reminds me of Credit Suisse Asset Management, but that's a different story. But when it comes to CSAM, yours, which is child sexual abuse material, it's very interesting because the data showing that actually increasingly there is usage of Monero as a privacy coin, I guess, to hide their traces. But Bitcoin is still used quite a lot. Why do you think a lot of these individuals or groups involved in child sexual abuse material are still using Bitcoin? And do you expect this mix of Monero and Bitcoin to change over the next couple of months and years?
Right. So there's a couple of things that I would raise. One is, you know, we used a heuristic to approximate Monero use. Which was CSAM vendors sending to instant exchanges that supported privacy tokens. So there's obviously a bit of an assumption there, but it's also a pathway that we've seen in various settings play out. And so it wasn't us just sort of reaching for the stars. It was like, we've seen this happen. If we observe this at scale, what kind of effects can we observe? Now the Bitcoin and Monero dimension that you were talking about, I think it's worthwhile to sort of think about this like graphically. So if you imagine a CSAM vendor in the center of things, the Monero dimension is like everything to the right of them, all the sending behavior. And so we were tracking in the report CSAM vendors or CSAM services that were essentially pivoting their sending behaviors away from Bitcoin or centralized services toward this sort of instant exchange Monero proxy that we had. But if you look at the other side of the dimension, like where is the value coming from into these CSAM vendors? That would be the consumer to the vendor side. That's still like predominantly Bitcoin denominated. And so you have a difference, I think, in the way I interpret it is like there's this clear difference emerging in the sophistication of actors in the ecosystem, that the consumer side is still very much denominated in Bitcoin. They're still engaging in that kind of activity. The vendors seem to be, as we tracked in that section of the report, they're growing in sophistication. They're using mixers more frequently. They're using this sort of privacy coin proxy. And that kind of behavior is very troubling because it makes attributions harder, it makes investigations harder, it makes finding and redressing the harm that's being done harder to do, all of which is extraordinarily negative, as you can imagine. And so I think it's crucial to kind of bear in mind, like we talked earlier about how different crime types are using different coins to different degrees, that kind of thing. In this case, what we're observing is different parts of the same ecosystem are using different types to different degrees.
Interesting. Yeah, it shows actually that there's kind of a user convenience element that a lot of these groups are looking for, with letting the users come in BTC, and then there's a sophisticated end of how the players, there's a B2C and B2B angle in a way from what you described. There's two more, we're almost out of time, but there's two topics I want to cover as well. One of them is sanctions. And it's very interesting, especially in the broader geopolitical context that we're living in today. Obviously, sanctions is like daily conversation in mainstream media. When it comes to use of crypto, when it comes to sanctions evasion, What are you guys seeing, and what are the type of activity that you're seeing when it comes to sanction evasion using crypto?
So we, it's an interesting question because the there's a few ways to think about sanctions. And at one level, there's sort of like, what is OFAC and the other sanctioning bodies doing? And one of the things that we detail in this section of the report is that they've kind of got an evolving, you know, operational strategy from what I can tell. You know, they moved from individuals in 2021 and prior into sanctioning big services, particularly those associated with ransomware and stolen fund activity in 2022, where you had Hydra, Garantex, and Tornado Cash all sanctioned. And then as you move into 2023, there's also been a movement there where if you look at one of the charts in the report, those associated with illicit drugs, so this is predominantly fentanyl and opioid related, those sanctioning events have increased significantly as a share of overall actions taken. So there's sort of a changing form of illicit activity that tends to attract sanctioning body attention. Now, the sanctioned evasion question is kind of like, how do you measure it? How do you talk about it? So as we look at it in our work, you know, if you're not sanctioned, you might be engaged in illicit activity, but you may not be engaged in sanction related evasion, for example. So this sanction evasion really kicks in when you're sort of sanction evasion or sanction violation is really like all the funds that come into a service after they've been sanctioned. And there we see, you know, as we talked about before, some services which have remained up in an operation predominate in terms of volumes there, because it's not uncommon for sanctions to be issued and then the services to be shut. That happened with Hydra, Blender, variety of others. But in some cases, Tornado Cash being one and Garantex being another, either because the service says we're not shutting down in the case of Garantex, or because it's a smart contract mixer in the case of Tornado Cash, you have the possibility over time of inflows continuing. And those are per se sanction violations from the perspective of OFAC and other sanction bodies. And so you do see a fair amount of volume associated with these services that are still up and running. But they're, you know, it has declined year over year, which is a positive sign.
You know, it's interesting not to be, I think from a pure legal perspective, I remember when, you know, they put the Tornado Cash address on the OFAC list. You know, it's very interesting. Can you put open source code on a list? And I remember this was being litigated. And I think it's such a fundamental question as well, regardless of what you think about sanction, is just the principle of putting that, I think, was a very interesting development that happened on a legal perspective. You know, one last question I want to go in, and before we do our quick fire round of question, Eric, is really when it comes to scams, right? So there's obviously crypto is back up. Obviously, whenever there's another bull market, we see increasing number of scams. One scam that we're seeing increasingly is these romance scams, these pig butchering scams. There was even a John Oliver episode about it recently as well. That was very interesting. And in the report, you guys talk about what we're seeing in Myanmar, with KK Park, and a lot of activity around these love scams. What are the trends you guys are seeing on that side, especially when it comes to size of scams and the way they're being done? Any particular trend that you're seeing that has come up in the last year?
Well, certainly in line with what the, you know, instances like pig butchering being covered on by John Oliver, we're certainly seeing a surge in volume associated with quote unquote pig butchering scams, a term, by the way, I cannot stand. You know, it's derogatory toward victims, which just bugs me to no end, neither here nor there at the moment, but nonetheless. So we're definitely seeing a surge in that respect. We are also seeing, as we've recorded for a couple of years now, that the average payments associated with this type of scam, so these much more interpersonal, you know, confidence building and then scamming activity, that the average associated with them is far, far higher than what we see with any other category of scamming activity that we observe. So, you know, the next highest is NFT scams, but it's, you know, a fair amount away from what we see with the average ransomware scam, or not ransomware scam, romance scam. And I think that really speaks to the effectiveness of the scams, as well as the interpersonal dimension, because it's not a greed motivation as much. So like with something like a giveaway scam, I like jokingly mentioned the Larry Fink giveaways that keeps getting bombarded at me by YouTube. There's a greed motivation there. That's going to be in some ways, I think about it from a psychological standpoint, a bit of a limiter, because if people are greedy, they don't want to give up their money, but they also want to try to capitalize. That's where the scam comes in. If someone builds a relationship with you and then parlays that trust into a prolonged scam, the amount of volume that gets stolen, the average payment, all these metrics of severity, they go way, way, way up. And that's what we've definitely observed over time here, which is unfortunate.
It's incredible. I mean, even personally, so many people reached out to me and they're often embarrassed, but who fell victim to these love scams, or the expression you don't like, the pig butchering one. It's actually such a big phenomenon now. It's absolutely incredible. But it is what it is. And unfortunately, I think with crypto becoming the bull market being in full force again, unfortunately, any type of these crimes will continue. So I think for those interested, by the way, in my podcast, I have an episode, as many of my followers know, like people impersonate me every week. So we've had actually for a period of time, like people were being scammed at $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 a month from me, but not the fake me. We did actually an episode with a victim who came on and talked about it, and we traced the money. It went to an exchange in Nigeria, but really, and often what I found in these cases, unfortunately, people are too ashamed to come forward. Which was the case as well with people being scammed by the fake Henry as well. Because obviously these scammers are very sophisticated. So it is, please guys, be careful with these things. Anybody comes, tells you they can do a generating 100% return a month. If it's too good to be true, often it's not the case. Eric, we're going to finish it off with my traditional, my bell is with me. I'm going to ask you quick questions. I need one or two word answers. And the bell is here to keep us honest and on our toes. I hope you're ready.
I'm ready.
Here we go. Eric, you're based in Canada. What's your favorite thing about Canada?
Rocky Mountains.
Wow, interesting. You studied political science in international relations at university. If you could go back to university now, what topic would you study?
Computer science.
Computer science. Here we go. Moving from the political one to the computer one. What's the one thing you love the most about the crypto industry?
The message of hope.
You were a professor lecturer at Virginia Tech. If there's one advice you could have for the university system globally to change, what would that be?
I think a return to the sort of the spirit of liberal arts education is what I would suggest.
Interesting. Interesting. Well, I think we could have a whole debate on that. Somebody has been lecturing in universities for over a decade. It's a good point. Another one. If you were not in crypto, what other industry would you be in, Eric?
Probably academia, yeah. I guess, since I was there.
Exactly. So this is a good one. Sam Bankman-Fried gives you a phone call. What's the one thing you tell him?
I probably wouldn't take the phone call.
Eric Jardine, this was, as you're the cyber crimes research lead at Chainalysis, the last question, the typical question, whoever is on my show, if you could have lunch or dinner with one person dead or alive, lunch or dinner with one person dead or alive, who would you have lunch with?
Two people immediately sprung to mind. One was Darwin. One was Michael Saylor. So,
man, pretty extremes, but hey,
yeah,
we'll take it. Eric, thanks for being with us today. How can people find out more about you and about the report and the work you guys do at Chainalysis?
So we have I'd suggest anyone who's sort of found the material that we've talked about here intriguing, the Chainalysis blog, which you can find pretty straightforward online, is a great go-to resource. It is filled, for example, with pre-releases of the various chapters that you can download and ask access for free. And it has a variety of other pieces of work that we've put out. So that would be a great touch point. LinkedIn and no longer Twitter, because I just found it was not my cup of tea. But yeah, The blog is the place to go. If you're curious about what we're talking about here, that's the place to go.
That's awesome. No, it's a highly report. I genuinely mean it. That's one of my favorite reports of the year. So, Eric, thank you very much for us, and thanks for your show, and thanks for all the support of Chainalysis for powering a lot of my educational content. A big thank you on behalf of the broader crypto community and a lot of my followers as well. Thank you very much, everybody. Hope you enjoyed the show, and make sure to check out my YouTube page as well, where there's a lot of exclusive content, and we can see the video version of this recording as well with Eric and myself. Thank you very much, everybody, and see you guys soon for another episode of the Future of Money podcast. See you guys soon.